Hello and welcome to Fantasy Talks Live, the podcast that came out of the Jose's Amazing World's YouTube channel. Original video recordings of all the episodes in the podcast can be found at Jose's Amazing Worlds in YouTube. Listeners beware, as plot spoilers can be discussed in any of the episodes in the podcast. And now, without further delay, enjoy the show. To get going, but I think we are live. So good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone who may be watching live or later on recorded. It is my absolute pleasure to be joined today by, keep calling you this, but Lady Grimdark herself, Holly Tinsley. Holly, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. It's one of the many things that people call me, and probably the nicest.
Okay. So we established I'm not that creative, and is clearly your reputation preceding you, right?
I would hope so. I hope it's my reputation preceding me, and not just people thinking that I'm some kind of dark, like, evil person.
Well, so I mean, okay, I'm going to try to structure this. We're going to go bit by bit, but we'll come back to this whole grimdark thing. So, as much as you want to tell us, like, what was your journey? Your journey been? How did you get to from whatever you did as a teenager, if you went to uni or not, to being an SPVFO finalist? Like, what's been your writing journey?
Wow. Okay. I mean, that's a big question. I mean, it was a lot easier to answer this question about 4 years ago when I started, because I could remember it all back then. It's been a while now. But in terms of, I mean, where I started from, I didn't have any aspirations growing up to write a book or to write in any way. I was really interested in theatre and music. That was my creative outlet growing up. And I was in theatre groups, and I wrote short play. I mean, technically that's writing, but it was short plays, comedy sketches, that kind of thing. And I got to probably my mid to late teens and realized that I actually wasn't very good at it, so I should probably try and do something else. And I think for a while, like, my creative journey really stalled, because I had a child very young. So I was 19 when I had my son. And I didn't go to university. I went straight into work. So I was working full time from a very young age, and I worked in different industries, and I met lots of people, and I traveled around. And I think just having those kind of several years of experience was a really good basis for me to start exploring different types of people, different types of cultures, who was out there in the world and what they were doing. And then probably, I think it was, gosh, I can't even remember now. Years ago, I got made redundant from a job. It was the third time that I got made redundant, and I began to see a pattern forming. And I thought, you know, I don't want to be in this position again. What do I want to do with my life? And I had a sort of an awakening at that point, I think in my kind of early 30s, where I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and go back to a more creative foundation. I thought, I've got all these ideas that are brewing for stories that I want to tell, so I'll sit down and write a book. I did that. I decided that I wasn't going to look for a job. I was fortunate to be in a position where I had the time to take some time out. I wrote my first novel, I think it was, in 6 weeks, and it was awful. It was absolute garbage fire, but not the one that I published, fortunately. But I think in that moment, I realised that I'd found what I wanted to do. And I think it was the right time for me to find it. So I started joining writing groups and kind of looking online for information. I'm very lucky. I have a lot of artistic friends who are writers and painters and actors and things like that. So I kind of pulled on those contacts to get advice. And yeah, it kind of snowballed from there. I wrote We Men of Ash and Shadow with very little expectation of it going anywhere. I knew I wanted to self-publish. I knew I wanted creative control. And I put it out there and I kind of got involved with talking to people in the community. And I think 6 weeks after it published, I was on the Grimdark panel for TBRCon with Peter McLean and Ben Galley, was it that? I can't remember who was on it, but it was authors that I would never have imagined even talking to, let alone being on a panel with. It was literally 6 weeks from publishing to kind of talking with those authors.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack there. So, I mean, first of all, that's an amazing journey. That literally 6 weeks, you put out We Men of Ash and Shadow, and you're already meeting Peter McLean, all these people you've mentioned. Let's backtrack a little bit. I mean, hats off, because I stopped writing when my kids were born. I think I still could manage a little bit of writing after the first one was born. Once the second one was born and with jobs, full-time jobs and everything, you know, I stopped writing years ago. And now after talking to, you know, so many people, falling down the page chewing rabbit hole and, you know, being on all the Friday conversations, it's like, I really want to do it again. I just materially, I mean, the state of mind that I'm in, I find it difficult to do it. So, you know, all credit to you for having your child and being able to do that at the same time. Like, I'm assuming you've got your partner, your family, some support group there to allow you to do the writing.
Mm-hmm. I was very lucky in the fact that because I had my son very young at this point in my life. I mean, he's 19 now. So when I started writing, he was about 13, 14. Okay. At least when I started writing properly. So he was at the point of being very self-sufficient. We were also quite fortunate the fact that I was able to, after discussing it with my husband, make the decision that if I wanted to do this, I had to go at it full time, full speed. So I really dropped back from I'd kind of been in very corporate, like management style work before that. And we did have to talk a lot about it. We did have to make a lot of sacrifices. So, you know, we don't go on holidays. We don't do exciting things. You know, everything that went into those 5 or so years was to do with writing and getting me to the position that I wanted to be in. I have great admiration for anyone who writes when they've got a family and full-time work and they don't have the opportunity to do that, because I imagine it is much harder and it is much more time consuming. So I'm very lucky in that aspect.
Well, I mean, and you've got my admiration for actually having that belief in yourself to say, this is what I want to do, and commit yourself to it full time. I think not very many of us have got that self-belief, or we're just too afraid to like set out on our own. I could never imagine working for myself. I think I'm too scared. I think I'm happy knowing that there's someone there that's going to pay me every month and, you know, to just get going there. So, you know, that's amazing. So I want to go even further back, and we'll get back to the panels and the success you've had. So as a teenager in your younger years, were you a keen reader? Is that something that came later? Were you always a bit of a bookworm? Yeah, that's the word.
I think I was a bookworm in phases more than anything. So I remember that there were particular like series that I really liked when I was growing up. So I liked, you know, the Terry Pratchett series. I liked Brian Jacques series. There was an author called Robin Jarvis who was my favourite as kind of a young child, like early teens. I think probably when I got to, probably after I had my son, actually, I really fell out of reading for a long time. And when I got back into it, I got back into it through biographies and like historical accounts of people's lives. So I'm very interested in people. And even now I will generally read more non-fiction than I read fiction. So I don't know what happened. At some point in my life, my brain switched over where it couldn't cope with novels. And whether it's an attention difficulty or it's just something about the way my mind works, I can take anything from 6 months to a year to read a single book, because I will pick that book up and come back to it and then leave it and come back to it. And in that time, I might go to another book. So I wouldn't say that I'm a bookworm. I would definitely say that I am a book. What's a good word for something that picks at things? I'm like a hen just picking at different things.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And did you take, because you talked about, you mentioned before talking to, you know, having artistic friends and talking to them, taking advice from them. But have you ever taken any formal writing courses or any sort of formal training to be a writer? And I'm saying this because we can talk about it later, but having read your first book in the Vanguard Chronicles, your writing is very accomplished. I mean, it is comparable or better to some traditionally published authors I've read. I mean, you are there, basically. I don't know what's the tipping point to get you from where you are to being traditionally published, but in my mind, you are there. So that skill that you have in the craft, how have you acquired that?
Well, thank you, first of all. I do really appreciate that. I feel like I should say, yes, I've done courses, or yes, I've, you know, done classes. But the honest answer is I haven't. What I've done is I've observed other people. And that's how I tend to learn a lot of things, is looking at what other authors are doing, how they're doing it, talking to them, being part of beta groups or kind of writing exchange groups, and just seeing what works and what doesn't. And I think that it's a great idea to have these courses and go on them if you're someone who can learn that way. But I have always struggled with academic learning. I find practical application a lot easier to absorb. So, you know, I don't think that would have necessarily worked for me the way it does for other people. But I think there are alternative ways to get that same information and that same kind of input from other people.
Right. Okay. That's very interesting. It's almost like there's some sort of untapped creative genius there that has managed to come out in spite of not having gone through traditionally formal channels, I would say. And so, hang on, I'm just going off on one here, but is this why Grimdark? Because you've been observing people and, you know, as humans are all fallible and are not necessarily at our best all the time. Is that where the Grimdark streak comes from? Is that a conscious thing, or is that what comes out naturally when you write?
Well, I think the whole Grimdark thing is quite funny, really, because I didn't actually know I was writing a Grimdark book when I wrote it. I wasn't even really aware of the genre, to be honest. It was kind of afterwards when I was looking at how to market it, and I started learning more about Grimdark and realised that a lot of the elements within the book kind of fell within that niche. When I actually wrote it, the things that inspired me, and this is actually something I don't think I've ever mentioned before, were superhero stories. So either like comics or graphic novels, or like films, TV. So we're talking about things like Watchmen or The Punisher, that sort of thing. So I think whether or not I actually ended up with a book that is in that genre, that's how I started it. Over kind of many drafts and edits, sort of morphed into Grimdark. But in terms of like people, I think, yeah, that is a huge element of it. My great interests in life are people and history and how people have reacted to and learnt from things throughout history. And also kind of a little bit of the psychology of that. I'm interested in the psychology of society as a whole and how we react to certain things in certain ways. And I think that does feed into that kind of grimdark theme of, you know, the grey morality of life and the darker side of human nature.
So, I mean, and so do you listen to or follow podcasts that may talk about social issues or historical events, or, you know, takes on, you know, current affairs?
Not so much podcasts. There's a lot of magazines and like publications that I read. I mean, I read them for my work generally anyway, because when I write a lot about social issues and things like what's happening in the government and what's happening with the economy and things like that. So I probably get more of that from newspapers, documentaries. If there are any good podcasts, though, I would love to hear about them because I would definitely be interested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, because like talking to you right now, I'm just, there's a very, well, at least here in Spain, but he's been translated into English, very well-renowned author, Arturo Pérez Reverte, who actually, prior to becoming a writer, he was a war correspondent back in the 70s and the 80s. And now he's a best-selling author here in Spain. You know the movie The Ninth Gate with, so that's based on one of his books.
Okay.
So obviously he doesn't write fantasy, but he writes these morally great characters, and it's all because it's what he saw in the war, you know, the wars that he covered in you know, in the Balkans, in Eritrea, and all the places that he went to. He said that in the morning he could see people being family men, loving parents, loving husbands, and they could be raping and plundering a village in the evening. So he saw people at their best and at their worst in the same day. So naturally, what comes out when he writes is that none of his characters are traditionally morally good or evil. It's just, you know, people. We are capable of the best and the worst.
Yeah.
Right. So, and now let's move on. So, you're a full-time writer, basically. You've written Women of Ash and Shadow. You consider it done. Did you send it to an editor? Did you get someone to look at it and give you advice, or was it your third, fourth, fifth draft and you were finally happy with it?
I had a really, really good editor, actually, called Charlotte, who I've worked with on the series so far. We kind of knew each other from moving in similar circles, but she was actually friends with another writer friend of mine. And she had done editorial for quite a while for novels and short stories, but actually left the industry about a year before I started writing, so wasn't actually doing it. And I remember she was talking with me and she said, you know, I'll read it for you, but I'm not actually editing anymore. Do you want to come down? I think we went to like the pub and we had a drink and I took the manuscript down and she had a look at it. And she actually ended up coming back to edit for me pretty much straight away because she just really enjoyed the book and really wanted to be a part of, you know, Team Vanguard, as we call ourselves. But she was fantastic all the way through. I mean, we just really clicked. And I think that's the most important element of working with any editor, is just making sure you work with somebody who is going to be part of the team with you.
Okay. So you don't have to answer it if you don't want to, but you've got the finished product. You're going to put it out there on Amazon. That's where I got it. You've got your editor. You got someone to do the cover design and all the stuff. So at this point, if you want to answer, how much has it cost you to produce this book?
That's a really difficult one to answer, purely because I have like signed like NDAs and things like that, which sounds really silly. But there's certain things that I can't talk about. What I will say though, in terms of cost, is that I have seen a lot of people who are new to the industry or people who aren't familiar with the industry who come in and they see the cost of self-publishing and they panic, and, you know, understandably so, because if you do it in a certain way, it can be incredibly expensive. But at the same time, just doing some research and kind of getting to know ways that you can do things that are within a more comfortable budget for you is very possible. So yes, you know, it is really important to have a good cover, but if you can get someone to do an illustration for you, they might charge you less than doing a full cover where they do the graphics and they do the title font for you. And those things you can really learn to do yourself. So for all of my covers, I have a piece of art made, but the cover itself, I format that myself, because that brings those costs down a little bit. So, you know, I totally understand how prohibitive it can feel for somebody who is trying to get a book out there, but there are just ways that you can really make it more realistic for yourself.
So, okay, you don't have to answer, but you can blink once or twice. So are we talking, are we talking hundreds? Are we talking thousands?
So my first book, Women of Ash and Shadow, without being specific, I didn't spend £1,000 on it in the first year of it being published.
Okay. That's as far as we can go. And I appreciate the answer. Not because I'm, you know, someone else from the Page Chewing forums, they've talked about, I think they spent a couple of thousand on one of their books. So, and you know, if people can, and you know, if you can and you want to go down that road, that's obviously fine by me. But I suppose it can be a very expensive hobby, although obviously for you it is not. You dedicate it to it. Okay, so now my question. You've got the book. Did you put it on Amazon? Was that your first go-to place to sell?
It was, and I know.
No, okay, fine. Hey, my books are on Amazon now, so no, I'm not judging here. What I'm getting at is, you got your book, you got your editor, you got your cover, you put it out there. Now you've got to change your mindset. Now you have to go from writer to publicist. So how did you go about, you know, drumming up interest and excitement for your book?
First thing I think I did, and I think this is the first thing that everybody needs to do, although obviously I'm not telling people what to do, I'm just saying this is my advice, is I think the temptation is there to go out and just mass promote everywhere and to put it on Twitter and social media and just blanket cover as much ground as you can. And maybe that will work for some people, maybe it won't. I think it's always best to find out where your market exists. So in the run-up to publishing We Men of Ash and Shadow, I probably spent a good 6 months beforehand doing lots and lots of market research, going into different online spaces, forums, groups, interacting with people, really finding those groups and those places where I would find the right audience for my book. And that meant sending out samples to people. It meant an extensive ARC list. So I think I put my ARC list on Facebook, I think, on a few different groups, and I got, I think, within the first couple of weeks, 50 ARCs sent out, so that come launch day, I'd already had people who had read the book, who had done reviews for me. And it's really about spending a good, solid piece of time cultivating that market and that audience, so people know your name, they know your face, they know what you're offering them, so that when you do launch, there's that level of excitement and level of anticipation for it. So it is a lot of time investment. And obviously it's going to be easier for some people than others, but I think it's really important to put in that groundwork before you go out there and launch, because there's a million people out there saying, I'm writing a book. You know, you've got to go and tell people what makes you different and why they particularly might want to read your book.
I was smiling as you were talking because I think this is incredible advice for anyone who is starting out or who is going about it and they don't quite know. I wish I had a bigger audience and that people will hear you say these things, because it's amazing. And I was also smiling because you're obviously a woman with a plan. You've certainly, it just shows, you've sat down and you've thought this through, not just the story that you wanted to write, but the whole thing, the whole journey of what it means to be a writer. It's not just writing a book, putting it out there. It's the whole marketing, the whole promoting, everything. And you know, I'm hats off, Holly. I'm really impressed with the level of Machiavellian thought that you've dedicated to this. So now we move on to the how big or how important was the SPVFO thing for you? Was it not? I mean, is it something that I heard some people say that it's not that big a deal anymore? I don't know. What was your experience with it? And how did you get there?
I mean, my experience was really positive. That's the honest answer for it. When I first thought about entering into it, I was aware of the competition. I didn't know a huge amount about it. So in one of my writers' groups, I knew a few people were planning to put their books into it. And a couple of them said, well, why don't you try it? And it's one of those situations where you go, oh, no, I wouldn't get anywhere. In the back of your head, you're just thinking, but what if, you know? I put it in there, and I, up until that year, I'd never really been that involved in it. It was just something that I was aware of. So I don't have any level of comparison year on year in terms of like popularity or scope or anything like that. For me, it was a really incredible journey where I got to meet and interact with so many different people on so many different levels, with so many different levels of success, you know, right from people who were bringing out their first book for the competition to people who had been in the competition several times and, you know, been finalists and things like that. So on a personal level, it was very emotional. It was very exciting. It was a roller coaster. On a professional level, it was one of the best things I ever did. I mean, it's obviously always going to help if you do well and get through to the final. And I think it helped that most of the people who were in the final that year had very different sorts of voices. So although kind of maybe thematically the books were all probably on the darker side, there was lots of different like styles and approaches to it. So there was a lot to talk about when we were discussing the various books. You know, you can't buy publicity like that. You really can't. And whether it's something that, you know, you want to do as an author, you're not quite sure about, I would say do it, because at the end of the day, you're here to sell books, and having that spotlight on you is going to help you sell books. So yeah, that's...
And from an economic perspective, it's the perfect gamble. There's zero downside and there's only upside, right? You lose nothing. And if it works out, it's all good, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the worst thing that you're going to get is you're going to get a negative review. And that's the case for whether your book's in SPFBO or whether it's in another award or if it's just on the internet. You know, that's the risk that you take writing a novel, is that people might not like it. But if you're going to take that risk, you know, go hard or go home. It's like, it's the way I look at it.
Okay. So you mentioned this, we're going to open that kind of worms. You put your work out there. Some people like it, like me. Some people may not like it. Have you received negative criticism, people that didn't like your book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even as part of the SPFBO, you know, I got mostly good reviews. I got a few middling ones, and I got one that was, you know, someone who really didn't enjoy it. And, you know, the funny thing was, is I think that the people who were following the conversation when that review came out were more bothered about it than I was necessarily. But, you know, it's the nature of the beast when you're doing this as a job, when you're putting things out there into, you know, the public space for people to read, that not everyone is going to like what you do. Not everyone's going to like you as a person or your viewpoints or your way of thinking. That's fine. It's just, that is the way the world is. You know, I've enjoyed conversations with people who have given me terrible reviews. Now, I will never reach out or contact anybody who has given me a bad review, because that's just not something that I would ever do. But I have had people come to me who I've, you know, maybe spoken to before, and they said, oh, I've read your book and actually I didn't really like it. Is that okay? Of course it's okay. It's absolutely fine. You know, it's, people have different tastes. They have different opinions. I think that there is an element of constructive criticism that comes from negative reviews. Anything other than that, it's, you just don't need to put energy into worrying about it, because that person who's read that book isn't worrying about how you feel about it when they say, oh, it's a 1 star, it's a 2 star. They're moving on to the next book. So, you know, without sounding negative, you then move on to the next review. There's no animosity in it. There's no, you know, bitterness about it. You just move on. It's just the way it is.
So a couple of things on this topic. So, I mean, I'm being honest, I really enjoyed your book, and I want to pick the next one in the series next year, and hopefully you'll be finished with the third one at some point soon, whenever it is, no pressure. Anyway, if I hadn't liked your book, I probably would have done the review as well. I probably would have still reached out to you to have this conversation. Would you have been as agreeable to have the conversation if I had not liked your book and I had given my reasons why, rather than just poo-poo it? I try not to do that unless it's the wheel of time. So, you know, would you have been as agreeable to be here tonight if I hadn't enjoyed your book as much as I did?
No, I think if I had been, I probably don't deserve to be invited onto these sorts of things anyway. Do you know what? The thought did cross my mind, because obviously, you know, you'd mentioned in the forums that you were reading it. And I know from that there's a chance that you're not going to enjoy it. And we'd already had this conversation about me coming on and talking to you. So, you know, I don't see why I would. I see why some people would back out of it, but no, I don't think so.
And admittedly, just so that everyone is clear, you agreed to come here, I think, before you watch my review, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. And then the most serious point, the more interesting one, those negative reviews, you read them, and then what effect do they have on you? So, like, do you go, not bothered, I know what I'm doing, maybe this person was just not my audience, and therefore I'm going to carry on with what I'm doing? Or is there a risk that you try to modify your style or what you're trying to do to broaden your appeal? I mean, what's the impact of those negative reviews on your writing, not on you as a person?
I mean, I think anyone who doesn't use their reviews as constructive criticism to grow probably isn't using reviews right in the first place. I think there's different kinds of reviews. So I'm quite lucky. I have never had a review that I felt was targeted at me personally or was vindictive in any way. All of the negative reviews I've had have been reasonably objective and just about the book itself. I think probably early on, one of the big themes that came out was that of POV. So POV has been a huge conversation in my writing journey, because as you probably noticed, I like to switch around points of view quite a lot. That's my preferred style. I know it's not one that is considered hugely popular in the way books are written at the moment, but it's kind of how they used to be written, and that's what I really enjoyed. So from the first book to the second book, I think there was a shift in me controlling that a lot more. And it didn't become about me taking that element out or me changing it to suit the market. It became about me presenting something better. So the POV shifts are still there, but because I was more experienced as a writer, I was just able to control them more and kind of apply that constructive criticism to improve the writing, or at least that was my intention.
Okay. I mean, I'm loving this conversation, by the way, so far. I mean, this is absolutely priceless. Thank you again for being here. Going a bit more into We Men of Ash and Shadow, where did the idea come from, and why did you choose that particular setting? Why these pseudo-Victorian, I call it grimdark by gaslight? Why that? Why not a more traditional, medieval setting? Why not a present-day parallel reality thing. What was the thought process leading to that particular setting?
Well, the funny thing, when I actually started writing it, I wanted to write something that was around the era, it was around the kind of the era of the French Revolution, because I was very heavily influenced by like Alexandre Dumas at the time. So I really loved that aesthetic. And also I had read the Perfume, which is set in that time as well. And I'd kind of watched a lot of films in that time. So that was what I was aiming for. And somewhere in the process of writing, we shifted forward about 100 years without me realizing it. But no, I think that period from kind of sort of French Revolution era through to probably pre-First World War is the part of history that I find the most interesting. I mean, obviously, I look at it from an English point of view because that's kind of the history I know more about. But even just in the broader scope of Europe, it was a really interesting, progressive time economically and socially. So it was where you were starting to see the first real shift from like church-led and aristocracy-led societies to a much more kind of public and government led. So you'd got the rise of healthcare, you'd got the rise of industry, you'd got the rise of unions, all that kind of very important political movement that really started to shape what we know now as like modern society, you know, started to look at things like people having the right to vote and, you know, Labour governments, all these different things that were going on. But at the same time, there was just mass crime. There was, you know, really huge issues with health and disease and, you know, class divides. And it was just a really interesting, story-rich time, I think, to draw on.
And why set it in a secondary world rather than in a, you know, pseudo-historical England, like a parallel history?
The complicated answer to that is because I wanted to create my own world and I wanted to have full control and blah, blah, blah. The simple answer to that is because I'm quite lazy in some ways, very focused in others, very lazy in others. And I didn't want to have to be accurate about things.
I understand that. It saves you a lot of research time and hard work. I totally get that.
Yeah.
So did you have any particular city in mind when you were writing, how do you pronounce it, Dorsey, where the main events take place? Any particular city in mind, or is it just an amalgamation of whatever you know?
It was sort of an amalgamation of kind of probably like France, Paris, that kind of area. So although it's a canal in the, rather than like a river or anything like that in the city, it was very much like based around things like the, I'm going to say it's around the Seine. Is it the Seine? Seine? The river in Paris, anyway.
River Seine. River Seine,
So a little bit of that. It was a little bit of London and also a little bit of Belfast as well. So when I kind of wrote the story, I had vision boards and mood boards with old photos from kind of those cities from that era, so I could kind of use them as a reference point.
Wow. Sorry. I'm just... So you actually had what dug up the internet for photos of that particular point in time of this. Your commitment to the cause is commendable. I keep saying this, but I don't think I've ever talked to anyone that has given that work the degree of thought and the commitment and the passion that you seem to have put into your books. So I'm, you know, most impressed. Sorry, I'm going to start gushing here. I'm going to try to stay cool about the whole thing. And your main, so my only point of criticism to you when I did the review, so just, you know, it wasn't all wine and roses. Why did you call it the Vanguard Chronicles? I think you're removing a key element there. You know, we know he's going to be around. Well, I think there was a mistake, if I may say so.
Do you know, when I watched the review and when I saw that bit, I was like, I really hope that we talk about this in the video. I was like, because it was such a good point. Now, I'll be honest, it hadn't really occurred to me in that way. But I will say, you are assuming that there is only one Vanguard through that. So, not that I'm saying that that's the case, but yeah. When it came to naming the series, I was really against naming it. I know that authors have to name their series in order to market them. So as much as I probably shouldn't say this, I put very little thought into the name of the series. The name of the book was really important to me. I really focused on that. And the Vanguard Chronicles as a series name really only came about because when I was inputting it into Amazon, as you do, I had to think of a series name in order to put it on there. And that was the one that I thought of at the time. And didn't really think about the fact that, like you say, it kind of implies certain things about the story. So okay. I thought that was a really good point, though.
Thank you. So, no spoiler. And I'm glad, because I didn't want to spoil the book. I don't think this is one of those conversations where we need to unpick the story. But so did that realization later on, did that affect what may happen in later books from what your original plan was?
I don't know, because at the moment the original plan is 90% of the story is already formed and kind of, if not fully written, at least drafted out. It's just the last 10% where I haven't made a decision yet, and I am admittedly struggling on making a decision. So I have probably at the moment about 8 alternative endings.
Kill them all.
It might be 9 now.
Kill them all. Okay, so let's talk about a little bit. One thing I've talked to other indie authors about is the notion, and you're going to correct me, and obviously things are working out for you, but that they have to write a series. And I think, rightly or wrongly, that maybe for an indie author, you're better off starting off with a book or a novella that stands alone and that hooks people in, and then you can then bring them along onto the bigger journey. Because clearly, that's not the case with We Men of Ash and Shadow. It doesn't work as a standalone. You need everything else. It's only like the prelude of bigger things to come. So did you do a J.K. Rowling? Did you plan out the whole thing from beginning to end, except for that last 10%? Was that the conscious decision from the word go?
Yeah, I mean, probably not in terms of an actually fleshed out story, but certainly in terms of right from the get-go, at least with the main kind of 3 or 4 characters, I knew exactly what their journey was going to be. I knew what their arc would be. I knew their relationships and how that they would interweave and how they would play into the kind of the final story and where everyone would end up. And that is still the case now, with the exception of one character who, through kind of natural progression, I won't say who it is, but you can probably guess. Through natural progression has changed and evolved as the story has. So I'm kind of now in a position where I probably, if I'd stuck to my guns, could have got all 3/4, however many it ends up being, books out, probably within a couple of years. The problem is that because the story has evolved, I now have to try and evolve with it. And that just takes a little bit of time and a little bit of readjustment. So, yeah, if you can do it, I think that's great. I think I always admire authors who can get out like a book a year and kind of finish a series within a couple of years. That was my intention. But what I don't want to do is I don't want to put out the wrong book. So I've kind of made that conscious decision to leave that little bit of a gap to just to let the story breathe.
So, I mean, this is really interesting. And I'm not to say that I'm not meant to ask if the story has run away from you, but have your characters surprised you? Have you had those moments writing where you've gone, oh, like this thing has taken a life of its own? And then have you tried to like keep it, you know, you guys stay where I need you to stay, or have you let them breathe and grow and sort of live their own life, so to speak?
I think for the most part, they've sort of behaved themselves. I mean, they've definitely changed. They've definitely evolved. There are characters who were never intended to be a major part of the series, who I think once I started kind of taking them out of my head and putting them onto the paper, I realised that actually they had a bigger role to play. So Hector Mandego, for example, was just a throwaway character at first. But as he kind of got written down, he started developing. So, yeah, I mean, for the most part, I think if the character naturally starts to run away with you, I think you follow where it goes and see where you end up.
I like the sound of that, because he looks like a character that is a cool character. It's not one that I don't want to see it killed in the first few pages of the next book. You've got an interesting gallery of rogues there. So the one thing I'm sort of, you know, metaphorically speaking, struggling to marry up is what a nasty piece of work you are to your characters in the first book. And then, in case people don't know, in your Dungeons and Dragons sessions that we play once a month, it is not that at all. They are very jolly and we have a good laugh. So it's like, this person in the Dungeons and Dragons game is not the person that is writing these books.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a few people say that. I mean, I've had people in my family like text me and say, what's wrong with you? That, you know, you've written this book. But I mean, I will say, I think with the D&D sessions, which we've been doing, which are absolutely fantastic, I've been very nice. I think because I'm trying to encourage people to enjoy the game. So, you know, maybe I need to up the ante a little bit on it. We shall see.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, in terms of my characters, I think that when I write, I never write from the perspective of wanting to write bad things happening to them. I write from the perspective of wanting to see how those characters survive and thrive and how they combat those challenges and those situations. And I always try to do it in a way that feels like poignant, or in a way that brings value to the story. So there are certain things that I think are gratuitous in, you know, particularly in the grimdark realm, which I don't think is always necessary to have in there. But I do think to have those situations and those challenges for the characters to see, you know, how is that grayscale of humanity that we talked about earlier, how is that going to flip, you know? And I can't remember the saying now, but I think there's something along the lines of the difference between a hero and a villain is how they react to pain. And I think that's something I always try to kind of bring into my stories. But to do that, I have to bring the pain in. So, yeah. You know.
No, I like that. And as you can see, our party bard is not looking forward to the future.
It'll be fine.
It'll be fine, yeah. So just moving a little bit away from all of this, Dungeons and Dragons. How did you fall down? That it's a super geeky thing. Although I suppose these days it's got a slight cool patina around it because of Stranger Things. And I think geek culture seems to be a bit more accepted. But certainly when I started playing, my God, we were the outcasts and the misfits of society. So How did that happen?
I think it was just a random thing, I think, where me and my husband, we've always been into like gaming, and we play like PC games, and you know, I make no secret of the fact that I absolutely love Assassin's Creed. That's just like my little chill out space that I go to, is I put on an Assassin's Creed and that's me happy for days. But you know, D&D, I think we discovered a group online, and we agreed to do a kind of trial run game with them. And at that point, we never played before, but we had been talking about trying to find a group for probably about a year beforehand. And just as we decided that we were going to go out and try and find someone, COVID hit and we went into lockdown. So we really found D&D through playing on Roll20. And through Discord and things like that. And we ended up playing with a regular group for probably, I mean, my husband still plays with them now. I've had to kind of pull back, unfortunately, because the schedules don't quite match up. But I mean, we played Tomb of Annihilation with them. I think we did Icewind Dale with them. So I kind of started playing. And as I started playing, my husband started DMing. And he said, oh, well, you write characters, why don't you write something for the campaign, and we'll sort of start bringing in some homebrew elements. So you know, I made NPCs and I made a few kind of scenarios and things like that, and we actually found the group enjoyed the homebrew probably a bit more than the pre-written stuff, which not every group will be like that. Some groups really enjoy the written stuff, some groups enjoy making it up as they go along. So I thought, you know what, if I can do this homebrew stuff, then why don't I try and, you know, start doing some DMing myself? So I kind of did a couple of games. My husband was there as like a wingman just to kind of help me out on the technical side. And yeah, I mean, my first game flying solo was the one that we played through the page chewing forums. So that was a really big deal for me. And it was, I have to say, you were all incredibly nice to me as well. Like, I'm sure there was moments where I was really panicking about what I was doing.
Well, I cannot talk for the rest, but the thing is that game for me has got a very, very special place in my heart. So for me, playing Dungeons and Dragons is some of the happiest memories of my childhood, because I think if it wasn't for that game, I don't know what would have happened to me. I've talked about this before. When I was a kid, I don't know if I want to say I had a pathological fear of losing, and it's not that I hated losing like Michael Jordan. No? I was so competitive that I always wanted to win. It's like, no, I really did not like losing in front of my friends. So I hated playing any game where I could lose. I didn't want to face that situation. Maybe the fear of being made fun of or whatever. And then I discovered Dungeons and Dragons. And it's like, oh my God, like no one loses here, or we're losers. Like, I don't know. But it's like, we're all working together. Like, and it spoke to me so much that, you know, I was off to the races. I started playing role-playing games when I was 10 years old. Like, D&D wasn't even translated into Spanish. You know, the older brother of a friend of mine, or the books from the US, and we kind of translated what we could at the time. And, you know, that was that. And Jared said that, yes.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think I even started playing, it was called Basic Dungeons and Dragons. It only went up to level 3, and then, you know, second edition arrived and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, but, you might enjoy, because I think there are more story-driven role-playing games out there other than Dungeons and Dragons. I think Call of Cthulhu is a particularly cool one, and it may appeal to you because it can be set in Victorian times or early 20th century, and it's got that sort of, you're going to die no matter what, whether it's through physical pain or through mental, you know, losing your sanity, the end is always the same. It may appeal to your darker nature a bit more.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, and that's one of the wonderful things about the internet these days, because I found a group again through Discord, and we play every week. And I got a friend of mine who lives in Belgium that I've known since we were 12 years old, and now we started playing together again. And it's just, I just love that game. It's just, to me, there's nothing better.
Yeah. I mean, I think I found a similar thing. One of the amazing things about it is that we spent a year trying to find what, you know, we kind of jokingly call it our people, you know, locally. And a year went by and we didn't find anybody that we could really connect with over this shared interest. And then we found this group, and we have, who is in the US, we have one player who is in Poland, one who's in Belgium. You know, it's amazing. All of a sudden, these people become your D&D neighbors and your D&D community, and that's a very rare and special thing.
Right. I think we're having some slight connection issues, but hopefully it'll calm down. So something I wrote about recently is how is the internet, how is not necessarily social media, but your life on the internet affected you? Because, you know, we've talked about it. For me, I live in a small town in Spain. I cannot talk about this with anyone anywhere near me. I cannot play D&D with anyone near me. I cannot discuss any fantasy series with anyone physically near me. And the internet has enabled me to carry on spending time and enjoying my hobbies and having these kind of conversations. And at one point I was questioning whether I was spending too much time talking to strangers on the internet than to people, you know, physically in person. How's that experience been like for you?
That's a really good question, I think, because I think it takes a while to step back from things like, you know, the internet usage. And like yourself, you know, you kind of took that moment to think, you know, am I doing the right thing here? Am I putting too much into this? Am I moving away from it? I think sometimes stepping back and having that conversation, working out where your boundaries lie, is really important. So for me, in anything I do, having separation and boundaries between my time and my different focuses is very important. It really has to be for me, because, you know, I write full time, I work on my own. If I'm not writing for work, I'm writing for books. If I'm not writing for books, I'm writing for marketing. If I'm not doing marketing, I'm on forums and on the internet. So, you know, I really have to be wary of compartmentalizing the different areas of my life online. So as part of that, I try to make sure that I keep a healthy amount of myself back. So my D&D friends are all online. They're all on the internet. My music friends are all in real life. You know, and obviously we follow each other on Facebook and Twitter and things, and we'll interact. But when we actually go out, we'll go out and we'll either go and watch them play some music, or we'll go and have like a, it sounds so hipster, but to have like a little jam session around their house where everyone brings instruments and stuff, you know, makes me sound much cooler than I actually am.
No, don't put yourself down. But so this is something that I struggled with when I used to live in London. I came again, south of Spain. Your friends were the people that you did everything with. Go to school, go out at night, go to bars, play Dungeons and Dragons, play football. It was the same group of people. When I moved to the UK, and maybe it's just a product of living in a big city like London, your friends are not your friends anymore. You just got groups of people, and people become a means to an end. So I've got my work colleagues, but they just work in that sphere of my life. Then there was a group of people I used to play football with after work, but they were the people I played football with. And then I used to play Dungeons and Dragons at the London D&D club. We used to meet in the function room of a pub somewhere in around Borough, Elephant and Castle. But they were the people I played Dungeons and Dragons with. So people became only useful for the utility to do things I wanted to. They were not really like an all-encompassing aspect of my life. So it kind of sounds like a little bit like you're describing that situation that I tried to move away from. Mm-hmm. Do you find that to be the case, maybe?
I mean, you could very well be right, and it could just be a different perspective. When I sit and think, you know, who are kind of those people that you're describing who would be my friends as my friends, not as part of like a social group or as any other kind of element of my life. And honestly, I could probably name four people in my life. I'm very close with my family, so I do spend a lot of time with family. We all kind of live very close to each other, so we're looking at that aspect. But I mean, I speak to one, maybe two people that I went to college with. I don't speak to anybody that I went to school with. And it's not through not liking them or not wanting to have those friendships. I think my life experience differed in the fact that, again, because I had my son very young, I was 19 when I had him. So I was kind of bringing him up through my early 20s up to my 30s. I mean, obviously, I'm still bringing him up now, but he's just older now and can do most things for himself. So I was kind of having those life experiences that most people have in their 30s when I was kind of just coming into my 20s. So the flip side of that is now most of my friends who are in their kind of 30s, they're at that stage in their life where they're starting to have children, people are settling down, they're into their careers and things. And I have a lot more flexibility and a lot more freedom. And what makes me really laugh is my friends will turn around and go, oh, we're really jealous because, you know, you get to live what they call a really exciting life. I mean, it's actually quite dull on a day-to-day basis. But from their perspective, you know, like, oh, you're writing books and you're going out to see music and you're, you know, being and you're doing all these different creative things. I'm like, well, yes, because this is now my time to do that. And your time will come after you've been through this phase of your life. You know, you need to enjoy where you are now. So that doesn't answer the question at all and goes off on a wild tangent. But, you know, it's kind of what's influenced that element of my life.
You know, it's cool. And there is something to be said for having children earlier in life. I had my first son when I was 35, and I think that's too late, personally. Because I keep thinking by the time he's 15 and a stroppy teenager, I'm going to be 50. So that's one of my incentives to stay fit, because I still need to be able to work him around the head if need be, which is why you need to get running again. Holly, we were talking about it. With that, but, you know, but having said all of that, you know, there's people here, Jared is here and Alex, and I really enjoy those Friday conversations that we have over at Page Chewing. I really enjoy this conversation, and I want to talk to these people more, because this is what I enjoy talking about. And there you go. There's a there's a fan there. There you go. maybe you haven't got the right look for a Princess of Grimdark.
No, I need to try a bit harder, really.
No. Being judgmental here. Right, sorry, let's get back to sort of more business talk. So is most of your promotion done online? Because I'm more familiar traditionally with the comics world. I mean, one of the things I miss about being in the UK was the great, you know, scene in comic conventions around London, Manchester, Birmingham, Portsmouth. You know, I used to go around the country. How much of that element of, you know, piling a box with your books and going around first and conventions have you done?
I have done in total one convention, and I didn't take any books at all. I just went to kind of scope it out. My author journey started the September before lockdown. So we had September release, and then I kind of did online marketing through the winter and Christmas and had planned for the next year to go out and do conventions and book tours and things like that and meet people. And then unfortunately we had two years thereabouts of COVID, where no one could go anywhere. So really the choice to go fully online with the promotion, the marketing, was forced rather than a conscious one. But in a way, I'm kind of glad it worked out that way. Obviously, we could have done without the pandemic. That was not good. But in terms of kind of forcing me to hone those skills in marketing online, talking to people through Twitter and social media, I had to learn how to do it because I didn't have any choice. I wouldn't have sold any books if I didn't. So my goal for the next few years is to take that kind of online presence, it's probably not that big, it's about 500 people who know what I'm doing at any one time, take that and put it into real life. So yeah, 2024 is going to be my year for in real life interactions.
So, okay, I look forward to the day when I can queue up a forbidden planning in London and have a book signed by you. I've done it for many authors and many artists, and you're going to be on my hit list for that. But, God, I was going to ask you something, and I just lost the plot. Right, so, because one of the cons I went to in London, it was mainly a Comic-Con, but these days all Comic-Cons seem to be about people dressing up in otaku outfits or whatever. And they had like a little fantasy authors section somewhere there. And there was Scott Lynch from the Gentleman Bastard series. And there was Brian McClellan. And there was a few other people that no one was giving a shit about. And I was like, no, but this guy, Brian Tchaikovsky was there as well. It's like, these people are awesome. Like no one care about them. So is that just less of a thing for books than for comics, maybe?
I think if we're being honest, I think that writers are rock stars to the people that read books. Really? But in terms of people actually knowing who they are, if an author walked down the street, probably 1 in 1,000 people might know who they are, if that. It's just one of those things where I think authors are people who are quietly public. I think most authors, I'm trying to think of the right way to put this, but you know, you're never going to hear of an author throwing a TV out of a hotel room window. You know, it's not that kind of a lifestyle. I think, yes, you know, authors will go out to conventions and they'll meet the people who read their books. And that is the best part of writing books, is getting to talk to the people that enjoy them and read them and get something out of them. But most authors aren't out there kind of coveting public fame or publicity for themselves. They want it for their work. So I think, you know, I just don't think it's ever going to be a thing where, you know, unless you're like a J.K. Rowling, who, let's face it, is famous now for all the wrong reasons rather than the right ones. You know, you're just not going to have that level of recognizability, if that's even a word. So, but I would love to go out to more conventions and meet people. I've seen some of the authors that I really admire going out to comic cons and things. So definitely worth it.
And so yes or no, and then that'll be my next question. Do you aspire, or do you want to be a traditionally published author?
The honest answer to that is I don't know. I think that there's a part of me, I think I'd like to know that I could, probably more than I would like to actually be one. Because A, I'm a control freak. So I like having full control over everything I do. I like setting my own deadlines. I like setting my own targets. So yeah, I think that element would be very hard for me to let go of. I think there is a lot of benefits, obviously, to being traditionally published. You have a lot more kind of financial support. You have a lot more marketing support. It takes that pressure off you. But I mean, the honest answer is now, I think you have to look at the reality of it. And the reality of it is that it doesn't matter how good you are when there are 15 million books being sent to three publishers in a year, you know, 99.9% of us are not ever going to have that opportunity. And that isn't because, you know, your book isn't good. It's not because you're not a good writer. It's because the industry has just shifted in a direction that means it is now so narrow that, you know, it's a crush to even get through the door to get looked at, never mind to get any further than that. So, you know, I think self-publishing is becoming more and more recognized. I think it is becoming more not regulated, because obviously it's not regulated, but I think there is now a lot more, there are more standards in place where people's expectations have risen. So, you know, it's not like the old days where, you know, someone could throw any old book out there. And yes, there is still some not so good work out there, and the rise of AI isn't helping with that. But in general, I think the people who are out there self-publishing, who are out promoting themselves, they're taking it seriously as a business. They're taking it seriously as a career. They're taking it seriously as an art form. So, you know, I think the line between whether trad is better or whether self-pub is better is just vanishing more and more as time goes on. I sound like this is something that's really important to me, but I think it is a really important discussion to have, and I think it's good that people are talking about this more.
Well, I'm glad you said that, and then shameless plug, because later in December, somehow I've landed a couple of interviews with Tim Makers. He's a traditionally published author by Ben Books, and we're going to be talking about the future of the fantasy landscape. But I've also got an interview lined up with an editor from Ben Books to know more about what they do, what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, you know, I'm going to be following this point of conversation later on in December. And I think, you know, anyone that is watching now or later, you know, stay tuned, because those conversations are going to happen. But I think you're right. The problem is, because self-publishing and technology has made it so much accessible to people, like, I think you could understand in the past the role of an editor, the role of an agent, the role of a publishing house. There were these sort of filter of quality, and not to say they were perfect, because they, you know, famously, J.K. Rowling, she got rejected by every Dick, Tom and Harry until Bloomsbury picked her up. I don't know why. So they're not perfect, but there was some sort of quality filter. Whereas now, even I have got my books on Amazon, you know, so if I can do it, anyone can do it. So in the self-publishing world, I think we're going to start needing some signaling system to separate the wheat from the chaff. I mean, and you got the well-deserved SPBFO sticker. So that, I don't know, that maybe is some way to go about it. So again, another question that maybe is a little bit tricky and you don't have to answer. So financially, is this working out for you? And I caught you at the wrong time. No, right. No, don't choke on me. That's not what I want to happen.
Okay, so financially, and again, I won't go into specifics, but I do think this is a really important thing for people who want to get into self-publishing to kind of learn more about. My first book made profit in the first year. So that's the first thing. That's the most important thing, is that all the costs and expenditure that I put into it, I had recouped in less than 12 months. So it is doable. It is achievable. Again, depends on how much you put into it as to how difficult that will be. If I were to quit what I call my professional writing, I would not be able to survive on what I make from books. I do make money from them. I do make profit from them. It is not enough to sustain a full-time living. And I think that's probably going to be the case with 95% of self-published authors, if not more. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't achieve that. I could put more time into marketing. I could put more money into, like, I don't at this point really pay for advertising. I do all my promotion through social media or through things like this. If I wanted to, I could go and put money into, you know, Amazon ads or Facebook ads, and that might work for me. I don't know. I haven't tried it.
I haven't heard very many good things about Amazon ads, but literally there was just some small talk over at the Patreon forums. So
yeah, no, I don't think I've heard great things about it. I know there are people who have used it and it has worked for them. They clearly have some magic marketing skill that, you know, the rest of us don't know about. But yeah, in terms of like the financials, I think knowing how much you're willing to invest in something compared to how much you want or need to get back from it, again, that's something you need to really work out before you go into it. Because at the end of the day, you can self-publish a book, not make any money from it, and just do it for the love of writing a book and putting it out there. You know, there's no rule that says everyone who self-publishes has to do it as a career move. You know, people do it because they want to leave something, you know, in the world that they've created. And that's just as valuable if that's what you want to achieve. So, you know, again, it's about setting those boundaries and knowing what it is that you want from the journey.
So it's a little bit like kind of like a lottery type thing, that you're going to put some money into it in the hope that you get something back, isn't it? And if worst case scenario, it's just an expensive hobby. And some people spend their money on drugs, tobacco, alcohol, collecting stamps, whatever your thrill may be. In your case, some in the past, in my case, we've put our money into producing the best book that we were capable of at the time with the means that we had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the way it works for most things, you know, that you decide to pursue in life. It's always going to be a lottery. You know, there's nothing to say if I had taken a different approach, I might be sat here having sold, you know, 50,000 copies of my first book, which, you know, unfortunately, as much as I hate to admit it, I have not sold 50,000 copies of my first book. So yeah, it's there's hard work, there's drive, there's motivation, but like anything in life, there is always an element of luck and timing.
But, and you gave me a really cool quote before, so I've got one for you now, and that you mentioned luck. They say that luck is where preparation and opportunity meet. And I think in your case, it's very clear. You've done the preparation. You've certainly, apart from writing, you did your market research, you did your looking into who was going to be your audience, what were going to be the best channels to promote your book. And I think it is important for people that want to, if your end goal is to just put your book out there on Amazon and finish it, then that's great. But if you're hoping for something a little bit more, I think you need to have that more sort of business entrepreneurial mind, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it comes down to you're only ever going to get as much as you're willing to put into something. You know, you have to decide what that's going to be at the start. Like I say, I was go big or go home. That was the level that I wanted to come in at. And I had to drive myself at that level. But that's not the rule. People set their own kind of path. They set their own pace. You know?
Absolutely. Okay. And then I think, I don't know, finally, we'll see how this goes. So we've got the Vanguard Chronicles. You mentioned to me that it's going to be 3/4 books. You're trying to figure out what's going to happen there. Mm-hmm. What comes after? You must have ideas bouncing around in your head. Are you going to stick to the genre? Would you like to do something totally different? Look into a different sort of format of storytelling? What's cooking there?
I want to do something different. However, anytime I try and start doing something different, I kind of accidentally fall back into this kind of same aesthetic. So I have a book at the moment which is currently being edited by Sarah Chaun, who edited the Anatomy of Fear anthology that I put out with some other authors about 3 weeks ago now, I think it was. So she's currently editing that for me with a view to hopefully releasing it in the spring. So that is a standalone, which is completely separate to anything else that I've written so far. That one is more 1920s. So I started writing it because I'd done a short story for another anthology and I had a character in it that I really liked and I wanted to use. So I kind of pulled that character out from that story and put him into this new one. So I'm really excited about that coming out. It is, again, I've fallen down the hole of not really specifying a genre. So it's fantasy. It's probably a little more on the magical side. Well, it's not hard to be more on the magical side than Vanguard, but it's, yeah, more on the magical side.
No, you're right. Okay, so here's something. Yeah, there you go. I thought that was going to be my last question to you, but now you brought it up. What's going on with the magic in Vanguard Chronicles? Is this something I'm going to find out more later? Because there seems to be some kind of mild magic going on. Is this something I can expect to learn more about in book two? Or is it just hinted at and it's just the way things are?
So you do kind of get some more answers in book two. I won't obviously go into it too much. What I will say with the whole magic conversation, and I'm really glad that you brought this up actually, is I think when we talk about fantasy books and we talk about magic, I think there's a very defined way of, or a very defined expectation of what magic is. So I mentioned earlier that when I started writing We Men of Ash and Shadow, what I was really trying to do was take the elements I enjoyed from superhero novels, and particularly novels where I think they're called mystery men. So you look at the likes of Frank Castle, The Punisher, Batman, you know, even to some extent, like, you know, Iron Man as well. Is these aren't people who have magical powers, but they do have abilities. Now, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that Vanguard is a superhero, but I think when I started writing it, I never at any point had magic in mind. So I think when people talk about magic, I think what they mean by magic and what I was kind of aiming for with the book are probably two very different things. So yes, there will definitely be answers though. There will be answers to all the questions.
But there's definitely something, let's call it supernatural, going on.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
Right, okay, and now you mentioned again Watchmen and Punisher and stuff like that. That was the other thing I wanted to ask you. Maybe I should come prepared with some notes or something. we're skipping from topic to topic. What? So you said you're not much of a fantasy reader, that you mostly read nonfiction and stuff like that. But in the realm of fantasy, what books do you hold particularly dear to you, or do you particularly rate that you may have read?
Oh, that is a good one. I mean,
if not, we can talk graphic novels, comics. I'm happy with either.
I mean, I'm one of these people that minutes someone asks me to name books, I always, like, all of them go out of my head. So, I mean, you mentioned earlier about Scott Lynch, who did the Gentleman Bastards series. Absolutely love that. That Liza Lamora was a huge influence on me.
I met Scott Lynch at the London Comic Con. He signed the first two books for me. I'm eagerly waiting for The Thorn of Amber Lane. But
I wrote to him when I first started writing. I'm going to sound really fangirl now, but I did actually write to him. Never received a response, which, you know, I totally get. You know, he gets millions of emails, but.
He replies on Twitter. When I used to have Twitter, he didn't reply to me. So maybe, or X, as it's called these days. You can reach out to him that way. But sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, Mark Lawrence as well. Obviously, his books have had a massive influence on me, the Prince of Thorns series. And just kind of, even in the indie world as well, I read a lot of indie published books. So it's going to, well, he won't hate me for saying it. He'd probably be happy I said it. But Peel Stewart, I really can't rate his books highly enough. You know, he's an absolute poet with words. The Drowned Kingdom series, just absolutely fantastic books, you know, just huge scope, huge world building, really well thought out and well put together. So, you know, it's hard really because I don't have a particular style of book that I enjoy. I just know what I like when I see it.
Oh, that's fair enough. And then when you were mentioning The Punisher and so on, are you thinking specifically the Garth Ennis run on The Punisher?
Sorry, say that one again.
When you were talking about The Punisher comic books, were you thinking specifically about the Garth Ennis run on the character or just the character of The Punisher?
I mean, I think probably more just the character in general. I think The Punisher, it's something that I'm more aware of through like the films and the TV shows, whereas with comic books, I think I'm probably more so... like it's like Alan Moore, like I think From Hell was the big one for me. So From Hell really influences a lot of my aesthetics. I enjoyed the series as it was kind of dark as it was, but I think it was a really, really observational series, just in terms of the human characteristics and the way that was portrayed. I don't know if you know, like the Penny Dreadful newspapers that they used to have in Victorian times where they'd make up like terrible names for murderers. And it was all very like about glamorizing, you know, like Jack the Ripper, and, you know, they'd have like the Backstreet Butcher and things like that. And it was real life news that was going on. And people were turning it into stories, and that was happening at the time. So I think just that idea of kind of fantasizing, that sounds terrible, but taking something real and making a monster out of it, you know, taking that very kind of human, very real scenario and almost transposing it onto, you know, a story about a monster or a story about a demon, or, you know, I feel like I've lost the thread of where I'm going, but I know the point I'm trying to make.
No, it's fair enough. And then maybe you can explain to me, because I agree with you about From Hell, but maybe you can explain to me that long speech when they go on that, you know, on the horse cart ride around London, and they draw the star as they go through the different sort of historical sites of London. I think that there's a deep thematic element to From Hell, apart from just the conspiracy story and the actual events of Jack the Ripper. Mm-hmm. But there you go. Going back to Vanguard Chronicles, you obviously got some very interesting characters, and you explore, like you mentioned before, how they react to bad things happening to them, and you're not afraid to go into, you know, people that live sort of on the fringe of society. You've got prostitutes, hired assassins, you know, my favorite bartender in any fantasy series, I think, or certainly my favorite pub. But I was going somewhere with this. Yeah. So I think the characters and the plot are clear, but is there something sort of deeper or something more sort of thematic that you want to touch on with the series? Or is it just a character exploration, which is obviously fair enough?
I think that there's certainly things that I wanted to kind of feature and touch on probably more from like a thematic stance rather than trying to make it a part of the narrative. But class divide and like the different levels of kind of economic privilege that people have is something that I think is very important in the way that the world is now. I think we like to think that we have moved on from the days of the gentry and the aristocrats ruling all, and the landed gentry, you know, swanning about while the peasants toil in the field. But actually, if you compare where we are to that, we really haven't moved that far away from it. You know, there are still these massive like social and economic divides between us that really don't need to exist at this point, and are created by culture. They're created by human decision. They're driven by human decision. So I think I really wanted to have that in the story. It's not because I'm trying to make any kind of political stand. It's not because I'm trying to teach anybody anything. It's just something that is important for me to reflect in the books, because that's my perspective of the world. So I don't know if that answers the question, but that's kind of I came at it.
Certainly does. I think it's very clear at one point in the book where you've got these very clearly delimited areas of the city where people are not allowed to cross over. And it sort of calls back to that time in the early 20th century, Chicago, when you had the big black migration from the south into the city, bringing the new forms of music, jazz and blues into Chicago, where the white rich people would go slamming into the poorer parts of the city to experience everything that was going on in those poorer black communities and so on. Perhaps, and I'm sorry to say, not the one of the strongest points of the first book, in my opinion. I think character and plot were more prominent over any sort of themes that were undercurrent to the story. I'm always, whenever I start these conversations, I'm always a little bit fearful, like, oh my God, what am I going to be talking about? How is this going to be any meaningful? But here we are, an hour and a half later, and I think this has gone really, really well. I'm mindful of the time. I mean, I'm an hour ahead and going to go to work tomorrow. I think I've asked you everything that I wanted to, and you've been fantastically accommodating and very forthright answering my questions. So I'm very, very grateful for that, Holly. Is there anything else you would like to say about where you're at, any projects you could go in, where people can find you, anything we haven't talked about?
In terms of the projects I've got going on, so I've got the one obviously that I mentioned that's being edited at the moment. That will hopefully be out. I'm aiming for spring of next year. The cover's done. Everything's kind of almost there. I'm working on the next Vanguard book. I don't have a timeline for that at the moment, but it is in the works. One thing I would like to ask, though, is I would like to ask you a question, because we've obviously had this discussion about you kind of exploring the indie world a little bit more in your reading and the kind of books that you're getting. Is there anyone at the moment who's sort of catching your eye or who you've got at the top of your TBR list from the indie world? Just because I'm really interested to know.
Well, so I've had a bit of an epiphany this year because I was very much like, you know, indie books, it's just people putting their crap out there. And you know, there's a bunch of psychos that just because they can fill pages with text, they think they can be a writer. But this year, I think I've had like 4 or 5 indie books, which is the most I've ever read in my life. I've never read any self-published books before. I think yours was top of the list for me this year. Not that it is a very extensive list, but you know, I'm definitely keen to pick up the next few books. There's been possibly more misses than hits. This one where I'm hoping that things improve a little bit and I'm curious about is Robert Bone, who's the first indie book that I read, or the second indie book I read this year. It's a gentleman from the US, sent me the book. And it's a very, very high fantasy, very classic stuff. But what I found interesting through talking to him is that he comes at it from a games designer point of view. So like, he doesn't have a vast history of fantasy reading. So he's coming at it with a very sort of unadulterated mind. And he's just not afraid to go places where fantasy hasn't gone in decades. I think fantasy to a large degree has lost the fantastical elements, and more what we get is secondary worlds that very much resemble our own, and the fantasy elements are almost non-existent. Magic is almost non-existent. Fantasy creatures are non-existent. And we're just gone away from telling an epic story to having these great characters. So I think sometimes I hearken back to my Dungeons and Dragons, you know, Lord of the Rings, Dragonlance, Forgotten Realms novels that I grew up with, and I sort of miss that in today's landscape.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Holly, once again, thank you ever so much for being here. I really, really enjoyed this conversation today. It's been amazing. And hopefully we can do the same in the future when I finish with book two.
Yeah, that'd be absolutely brilliant. I really appreciate you talking to me. It has been absolutely great. And I look forward to the next D&D session.
Indeed. So long as you promise to make it a little bit harder on the encounters. Make us sweat a little bit more to come out alive.
I promise.
Brilliant. Where can people find you? Where can people find your books?
So they can find me on mostly Twitter. I am on a bit of a social media kind of hiatus at the moment. I do pop in occasionally, but I will be back shortly. I am on Amazon. I am on my own website, which is Holly Tinsley Writes. My books are on there as well. And very rarely you will find me lurking on Discord. Very rarely. So if you see me on Discord, then just wave or say hi.
Brilliant. Right. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone that popped in today. We had Alex and Jarrod, and I think Mr. Stewart was here as well. And thank you for popping in, everyone. Take lots of care, and we'll see you soon. Bye.
Bye.
And then I think this awkward 3 seconds again.